Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode 319. This week, I've got a couple good articles for you all. I hope you really enjoy those. I also have illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison, who stops by for another great segment of the Masonic Minute. In the news this week, not a whole lot going on. I did have to update some of the presentation schedule on the website. So if you head on over to wcypodcast.com, just so you guys are aware, February 9th, I'll be at Libertyville Lodge in Libertyville, Illinois. March 16th, I'll be at Shekamenko Lodge number 458, New York. I'll be doing the Lost Word. March 21st, I'll be doing a Skype presentation for Liberty Lodge in Missouri. And then I kind of start what I will call the mini tour. So April 11th, I'll be at Triandria Lodge in Ohio. April 12th, I'll be at Willoughby Chapter in Ohio. And April 13th, I should be at Port Jervis Lodge in New York before heading home. Right around June 7th, I'll be at Honesdale in Pennsylvania. And August 9th through the 12th, I plan to head on over to Toledo, Ohio and attend Camp Masonry, where I'll do Esoterics 101 for the masses there. And then we'll do the Word in a more private setting. So again, if you're interested in having me come out, shoot me an email. I'm super flexible. I just ask for travel and accommodation. So that means you get me there and give me a place to sleep and I'm there. That's all. So it's always fun. We have several really cool topics that I can speak to, whether it's history or esoterics or technology or the use of technology in Freemasonry. But hopefully you find something you like. And if you want to have me out, just shoot me an email. Just a quick word that for a while, the podcast source application, if you downloaded it and you searched for Whence Came You, it wasn't coming up. This is due to the fact that we record and we upload to the service, but due to some technical error on their side of things, it wasn't showing up in the application. So it is fixed. If you download the podcast source application for your mobile device, whatever you have, it's out there. You download that. Once you have it, you then do a search in the app for Whence Came You podcast, and you'll see, and you can subscribe to our show right there. What that does is it gives you instant access to all the episodes. So this is unlike iTunes, because at iTunes, it only gives us 300 episodes that it'll show. So episode 1 through 19 won't show in iTunes anymore, just 20 on up to 319. So because of that, the podcast source app is really cool. And also the other reason to download the app is, of course, you get access to a lot of extra content. So I upload into the app every week at least a Masonic wallpaper for your mobile device that I put together. Sometimes they're amazing, sometimes they're not the greatest. However, it's all free. And the other thing that we do is I try to upload some additional content. So whether that's the paper we read that week, or the issue of the whole magazine that we read, or something else, it's usually uploaded there for you. Sometimes even videos. So please check that out. Just on your app store, on Google Play, whatever. If you're on Windows 10, there's a Windows 10 app. It's Podcast Source. Once you download that, search while you're inside for Whence Came You, and you'll come across it. I also want to thank all the people who help keep this show alive. Thank you so much, guys. And with that, I'd like to get right into this week's first piece, which is pretty awesome. And it comes from the May 1920 issue of Rosicrucian Fellowship Magazine, Mystic Light, Rays from the Rose Cross. The editor, of course, Mrs. Max Heindel. Max Heindel is a wonderful author. I own several of his works, and I'm a big fan of the magazine from back in the day. Some really great content there. So I'd like to read you an article from the magazine. It's on page 11, and we will take this entire issue, and I'll upload it into the app so that you guys all have access to it. So this article is called Swedenborg and His Alleged Masonic Connections. Now, before we dive in, it's important to understand who Swedenborg is. So we had the Swedenborgian Rite. That may ring some bells for some folks, but this is essentially a non-Masonic magazine. It's Rosicrucian in nature. Now, Rosicrucianism and Martinism are both areas within Freemasonry that you can aspire to if you are invited to join and you meet those criteria that they're looking for. In some cases, in some places, these are, I'll use the term dumbed down, and I don't mean that to be offensive, but it is dumbed down to a dinner club in some locations. However, other locations, I understand, like in Utah, the Rosicrucian side of Freemasonry there is going strong with good education, and they're doing wonderful. So without any further ado, though, I'd like to get into this Rosicrucian article about Swedenborg and his alleged Masonic connections by J.H. Among the occult writers of the 18th century, perhaps the most important is Emanuel Swedenborg. Born in Stockholm in 1688, he graduated at the University of Uppsala at the age of 21, and in 1710 wrote an excellent ode in celebration of a great victory, beginning thus, quote, "Lulled be the dissonance of war, the crash of blood-stained arms, and let us listen now to sweetest songs of jubilee. From harp and thrilling lyre, let melodies of joy ring to the stars, and every sphere of space glow with the inspiring soul of harmony." End quote. Soon after his graduation, he began to travel in foreign countries, and was the usual custom of his day, and became known as a scientific and philosophical writer. His studies included everything under the sun, from the dead mineral in the bowels of the earth to the living organisms that inhabit the human brain. Up to the age of 55, he lived in the world as a practical scientist, entirely unconscious of the fact that the all-seeing eye was gradually preparing him for the great work to which he had been elected. This work could never have been performed had he been able to foresee the coming events that cast their shadows before him. Then, in 1743, at the exact moment indicated by the clock of destiny, something of a miracle happened which no living person has ever been able to fully explain. Swedenborg, the scientist, passed out of physical existence, and a new personality took his place. This new Swedenborg, new in mind and heart and body, had almost no interest in science, philosophy, or the affairs of this world, which had been the chief concern of the old, but the ruling love of this new man was the exploration of the new world into which he had been born. The miracle of Swedenborg's birth into a new and higher life does not consist so much in that he was permitted to have conscious communication with angels and dissonant spirits, as in the fact that he was ordered to publish what he saw and heard, and thus to be a witness of immortality to the mortals he had left behind. The impression which the experience of his admission to the land of the living dead made upon his mind was so strong that he afterwards worked with an energy and perseverance which was oblivious to everything else except the revelation of the things heard and seen in the spiritual world. In his age, he must have labored day and night to produce those many works which reveal the love, the wisdom, and the power of the Word. One of the first great truths that Swedenborg brought back from the world of the discarnate and invisible spirits to enlighten the minds of men was the doctrine concerning the laws of the divine providence and their operations in the physical world, whereby the human race is led step by step to a higher and higher perfection. These doctrines make Swedenborg very interesting to the occult student, and especially to the student of Rosicrucian teachings. In this world, most events are ascribed to a man's own sagacity, and the rest are supposed to be the result of chance, fate, or luck. Ordinarily, things that cannot be handled, felt, heard, and seen are not conceded to exist except in the imagination of visionary dreamers and the weak-minded people. Governments make war and declare peace. Kings are made by soldiers and beggars by millionaires. Men rule and women are ruled by their own wits, and God is left out of the question entirely. The devil gets the hindmost all the time, so it seems. But the student of the Rosicrucian philosophy knows that there are other worlds and other principalities and powers which are the more real because they are invisible to ordinary sight, and Swedenborg knew it, for he had passed beyond this world of effects into the world of living causes. There he saw that there is no such thing as a chance or luck. He saw supreme intelligence in operation, and he testifies in the strongest manner to his experience of higher powers and to his vision of invisible worlds, of causes governed by immutable laws which extend to the minutest details of every event that ever, quote-unquote, happens in this world, where kings and rulers of kings find it so difficult to believe that there is a divine and universal government ruling all nations with a rod of iron. He saw that those who believe themselves master here are in reality slaves and ruled absolutely by means of spirits whose existence they deny because they cannot see them and put them behind prison bars. They would quake with the fear if they were brought into contact with those monsters invisible to ordinary sight, who must be fought with the terrors of the divine justice upon their own plane, where no ordinary weapon can reach them. It is on this spiritual plane where battles are fought that make things fade into insignificance. There also are to be found the real benefactors and saviors of the human race, who out of pure love guide those who are in darkness and the shadow of death. There are those compassionate ones whose spiritual splendor and sublime greatness would bring to their knees even better than John of Patmos. The students and readers of this magazine know something of these hierarchies and their sublime work. Shall we deny these spiritual realities just because we cannot see them and because their work is as silent and as noiseless as that of the marching orbs in the blue heaven? Swedenborg saw them, and what he saw made his heart burn with a love that almost consumed him. Translating his spiritual experience into a natural language, he wrote, quote, "Who does not know that there is such love which surpasses all other loves in excellence and in pleasantness, so that all others in respect to this are of little account, that it surpasses the love of self, the love of world, yea, the love of life? Experience testifies. Have there not been, and are there not still, those who for the women desired and solicited for a bride fall upon their knees, adore her as a goddess, and submit themselves to her good pleasure as the vilest slaves? A proof that this love surpasses the love of self. Have there not been, and are there not those who for such a woman regard riches, yea, treasures, if they possess them, as nothing, and who also spend them lavishly? A proof that this love surpasses the love of the world. Have there not been, and are there not those who for such a woman esteem their own lives as worthless and earnestly desire to die unless she engages herself in according to their wish, as many deadly combats of rivals testify, a proof that this love surpasses the love of life? Have there not been, and are there not those who for such a woman have become frantic from being refused by her? The woman here spoken of is a natural symbol of what his clairvoyance revealed to him in the other world. He had found the bride, the Lamb's wife, and for the first time he knew what love is. He had prepared the golden wedding garment and had been received among the friends of the bridegroom. He had seen her clothed with the sun and with the moon under her feet. He had ceased to deny the reality of the invisible and had been convinced through the personal experience that, quote-unquote, the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. Seeing the divine providence in actual operation in the physical world, he could understand how difficult it must be for one whose spiritual eyes are closed to believe that the spiritual leaders of the true holy empire, who are gifted with real knowledge and power, deal with nations and their destinies as a little child deals with its soldiers of lead, or as the potter deals with his clay. Looking back upon his own state of ignorance in the physical world, he wondered why he had not become sooner convinced that there must be a supreme intelligence guiding humanity upon that path of progress in a more direct way than is discovered by blind faith. On August 27, 1748, he wrote, "Before my mind was opened so that I could speak with spirits and thus be persuaded by living experience, such evidence were presented to me during many previous years that now I wonder that I did not then become convinced of the Lord's ruling by means of spirits. These evidences were not only dreams for some years informing me concerning these things which I was writing, but also changes of state while I was writing, and a certain extraordinary light on what was written. Afterwards, I had also many visions while my eyes were closed. A light was miraculously given, and many times spirits were sensibly perceived as manifestly to the sense as bodily sensations. Afterward, also, I had infestations by various ways from evil spirits and temptations whilst I was writing such things as evil spirits were averse to, so that I was beset almost to horror. Fiery lights were seen, talking was heard in the morning time, besides many other things, until at last, when a certain spirit addressed me in a few words, I wondered greatly that he should perceive my thoughts, and afterwards wondered exceedingly when the way was opened, so that I could converse with spirits. And then the spirits wondered that I should be so surprised. From these things it may be concluded how difficult it is for man to be led to believe that he is ruled by the Lord through spirits, and with what difficulty he recedes from the opinion that he lives his own life from himself without spirits. I have at one time perceived, some months after beginning to speak with spirits, that if I should be let back into my former state, I might relapse into the opinions that these things were fantasies." End quote. The materialist who does not believe in spirits will find such statements wild and unreasonable and will probably reject them as imaginations of an unsound dreamer. But to a student of the Western wisdom teachings, they sound familiar. This article, however, is not written to offer the Arcana Coelestia of Swedenborg as a precedent to the Rosicrucian cosmo-conception or to compare his quote-unquote Earths in the universe with the quote-unquote messages of the stars. It is intended to cast a few rays from the Rose Cross upon Swedenborg's alleged Masonic connections and incidentally upon Freemasonry itself. Some Masonic writers have placed Swedenborg among the great Masonic leaders of the 18th century, whilst others are sure of the fact that he never was a Mason. They admit that nearly all of his intimate friends belonged to the order, and that he was a remarkable man whose revelations have astonished the world. But whether he was a Rosicrucian, a Freemason, or a member of another occult society, they have not been able to decide definitely. As the Rosicrucian order is often believed to be a part of the degree of Masonry, and, quote-unquote, the Masons of today have but very little of the occult ritual left, it will not be out of place here to show the difference between a truly occult brotherhood and a fraternal society whose secrets, with the exception of a few passwords, are published broadcast in books and magazines. The student of occultism will find in Swedenborg a veritable mine of esoteric knowledge. Swedenborg wrote in Latin, not merely to reveal the spiritual sense of the Bible, but also to conceal anew what he revealed. He wrote many words in capital letters without any apparent reason. He wrote many memorable relations, which are memorable in more than one sense. He wrote a great work on the conjugal love and closed it with a cryptic key which turns the lock to wonders beyond wonders. This key was handed to Swedenborg by an angelic spirit with the single command, write. And he did write, having been given access to a certain closed room in which is kept a parchment containing the arcana of wisdom, not hitherto made known in the world. See Swedenborg's Delights of Wisdom Pertaining to Conjugal Love, number 43. This one key soon reveals other keys belonging to a different distinct degrees, and the whole mystery becomes more and more extensive so that one wonders how such an immense weight of occult knowledge can be balanced on a single brain. The reality of the spiritual worlds and the life of spirits and angels is made visible almost to the natural eye, and the influence and the power of the so-called dead are made manifest through facts and mediate and immediate experience. The worlds of the poet are verified. Quote, there are more things in heaven and earth that are dreamt of in your philosophy. End quote. The use of the cryptic key is characteristic of Swedenborg's ability to write in correspondences, and it gives one an insight into the deeper mysteries of Masonry, of mystic Masonry, which is as different from ordinary Masonry as the Rosicrucian cosmo-conception is different from the morals and dogma. Samuel Beswick, in his book The Swedenborg Rite and the Great Masonic Leaders of the 18th Century, says that Swedenborg was initiated at Lund in Sweden, but this is denied by Mackey and others. A letter which Swedenborg wrote from Brunsbo to Benzelius, and which is not mentioned by Beswick, has this interesting information. Quote, enclosed I send you something which I found to write at Brunsbo. It is a new method of calculation which I received a hint while I was at Lund. My dear friend is still at Lund. He is about to argue his and has perhaps done so already. This probably was an essay on the use of the Swedish language. In his quote-unquote note conclusory, Beswick says, quote, from the very moment of his initiation, Swedenborg appears to have resolved never to allude to his membership or to his knowledge of Freemasonry either publicly or privately. He appears to have made up his mind to keep a profound secret and to regard it as something which had no relation to his public life. End quote. Beswick further states that he had the pleasure of conferring 3 degrees of the Swedenborgian Rite upon one of the highest past officers of the Supreme Council of the 33rd degree, ancient and accepted rite, Gils Fonda, Yates, past MP, Sovereign Grand Commander of the Supreme Council, on the 29th of August 1859, a few months before his death. There is no reason to doubt this statement, proving the existence of a Swedenborgian rite only a few years ago. To be continued. So there you have the first part in this series. I will look for the second half of this and try to read it maybe next week. I found the article to be quite interesting. In fact, the first half of it should give you a somewhat of a cursory look into the deeper realms of what many Masons are actually into. There are Masons in our lodges today that do this and read this kind of stuff all the time. I'm one of them. However, I understand that a lot of that might sound totally foreign and crazy to some Freemasons, and I understand that. But I should mention that Heindel mentioned in the article that this type of masonry, this mystic masonry, is as different to regular fraternal masonry as morals and dogma is to the cosmo conception of the Rosicrucian order. Now, I myself am not a Rosicrucian. I don't really meet those spiritual qualifications, but nonetheless, I find that the Rosicrucian order necessarily is just a reimagining of the same philosophies of Hermes Trismegistus, or Trismegistus, or whichever you prefer to pronounce. The last thing I'd like to mention is that you heard two times in this article beeps, and those beeps were because I said something in the article that I'd rather not say, so I just bleeped it out. Masons, you'll know what I'm saying, likely. If not, you can write me and let me know what lodge you're from, and I'll tell you what it was. But in any case, what's fascinating there is this idea that nobody has definitively said whether Swedenborg was a Mason or not. I think it's pretty well understood today that he was a Mason, and there's an entire rite based on his work. My other point that I'd like to mention in here is that there was a quote from Shakespeare, which I don't know if anybody picked it up. If you did, great, good for you. It was, "There are more things in heaven and earth that are dreamt of in your philosophy." And that is a quote from Shakespeare. In fact, that same quote is given several times in many different episodes of The Twilight Zone. I believe it was a favorite of Mr. Rod Serling. So next we'll go on to the Masonic Minute. I hope you guys enjoyed.
A few years ago, while visiting the Pony Express Museum in St. Joseph, Missouri, I thought it would be a great project to research the writers, find out which ones were Masons, and write a little piece about each of them. Without going into great detail, let's just say that history is lost, not to mention the fact that most of the writers were too young to be Masons in the first place. I gave up on the article until I found out the two major founders of the Pony Express, William Russell and Alexander Majors, were in fact Freemasons. A third founder, William Waddell, served mainly as the financier, while brothers Russell and Majors were the hands-on forces driving the company. As such, they demanded high standards of conduct from the riders, which reflected their Masonic values. Prior to joining the company, each rider had to repeat the following obligation with its obvious Masonic undertones. You will raise your arm to a level square and repeat after me. I do hereby swear before the great and living God that during my engagement, I will under no circumstances use profane language, that I will drink no intoxicating liquors, that I will not quarrel or fight with any other employee of the firm, and that in every respect I will conduct myself honestly, be faithful to my duties, and so direct all my acts as to win the confidence of my employers, so help me God. Beginning April 3, 1860, the riders relayed mail on horseback from St. Joseph to Sacramento. The trip took about 10 days and, at the time, it was the fastest way to communicate with settlers on the West Coast. The Pony Express has become an iconic part of American history, even though it only operated less than 19 months until October 24, 1861, when the completion of the Transcontinental Telegraph Line put it out of business. Although many of the writers' histories had been lost, there was one who, after writing for the Pony Express at age 14, became world famous later in life. His name was William Cody, better known as Buffalo Bill, who a decade later became a member of Platte Valley Lodge No. 32 in Nebraska. His legendary exploits began as a rider, where he was said to have completed the longest ride ever, going over 300 miles in a single day. Living in an age of traveling entertainment, Cody assembled his own entourage, commonly known as Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show. The production staged reenactments of Custer's Last Stand, robberies, and of course, Pony Express rides. Over time, the show made Cody famous and wealthy by the standards of his day. After the collapse of the Pony Express, the founders lost their fortunes and never really recovered. Brother Majors was especially hard hit, winding up penniless and living in a shack. It was in that condition that Brother Cody found him 20 years after the organization had folded. Cody not only furnished the assistance necessary for Majors to get back on his feet, but also provided him with a contact to help finish his memoirs, employing those Masonic tenets of brotherly love and relief. Buffalo Bill came to the assistance of his former employer, a brother who had given him his start many years prior. As Freemasons, that's the kind of thing we do. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
All right. As always, super huge thanks goes out to illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison, who works so hard to bring us these amazing segments, bring us the history, bring us the stories that are always enlightening and entertaining. So thanks so much. If you guys like that, please head on over to wcypodcast.com. Click on the link for the bookstore. It's in one of those drop downs. And there's just links to the books that have been written by various people on the show. And we have links that take you back to amazon.com, direct links to the books written by especially guys like illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison. If you liked that kind of thing, Tales from the Craft is right up your alley. And of course, one of my favorites is Freemasonry at Oak Island. All right, I've got one more article for you this week. I hope you enjoy. So the other article I've got for you this week comes from the Heretic magazine, Think Again. This is theheretic.com. So they've got some articles on here. Doesn't look like it's been updated in a little while, but you know, good content is good content. This piece was actually written by Brother Duncan Burden, who lives in Hertfordshire, England. And the title of this short piece is called What Could the Philosopher's Stone Be? Written back in December 2nd of 2015. In my youth, I would regularly be found reading a book related to either the Holy Grail or the Philosopher's Stone. At times, the authors of these books would interchange the terms, implying that they were the same. Perhaps they are. In reading these books, especially those more focused on the term or subject Philosopher's Stone, I quickly realized how broad the general interpretation of this item or concept was. To some, including the authors of novels like Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, or Sorcerer's Stone in some countries, the term denotes a magical stone. Yet, in some alchemical texts, it is a metaphor for turning lead into gold. For others, it is a device linked to everlasting youth. The list goes on and on. The only common element amongst all of the stories and studies is simply the name, the quote-unquote Philosopher's Stone. This raises an observation. Instead of a name for this item, we actually have a term. For example, in the Star Wars films, we have the good guys, the Jedi, and the bad guys, the Sith. Both are made-up words to describe a unique concept. As we watch the films being told, those descriptions we accept and recognize them, not only distinctly for the context of the plot, but also in social discussion. Yet, whatever the Philosopher's Stone is, it is not a totally unique word, but rather two words put together to create a term that is meant to represent something unique. So what is actually intended to be should logically relate to how we would review these two words, both individually and collectively. Indeed, it could be possible that it is just a creative phrase which gained popularity, that the peculiar combining of two unrelated concepts created an enigmatic expression which conveyed an enigma. Or it is possible that the key to discovering the, or a, Philosopher's Stone is actually in the words itself. For example, the first term, philosopher. This almost universally conjures the image of a scholar using logic and reason to answer the meaning of life, to creation, to the divine. While the term stone could either be seen literally as a small rock or something emotive. Thus we call someone our rock, as if they were someone we could rely on in time of need. St. Peter is considered the quote-unquote rock of the church, conveying him as a firm, solid foundation. Thus the term stone. if taken in recognition of all physical matter, especially the classical sense, is seen as a metaphor of something solid, real, and unchanging. In this case, then, a nice curiosity exists between combining the two words, as a philosophy is not based in fact, but rather in reason and logic. When a philosopher puts forward a theory, it is exactly that, a theory. Hence, what would be the greatest possession of a philosopher? Perhaps a factual, real, solid answer to a theoretical question. This would be extremely rare, if not impossible, for the nature of what philosophy is, by stating this paradox, implies not only what the philosopher's stone could be, but also that it has attributed value of rarity. So, what could be a philosopher's stone? I guess something solid that could prove the existence of God, or the meaning of life, or creation, anything that we would normally attribute only to a theory, but is answered by a solid fact, a real, tangible reality that could not be denied by anyone, because it would be as real as the stone in your hand. All right, and that article is from The Heretic Magazine. We'll have links to that right in the show notes. The Heretic Magazine, so you can go to thehereticmagazine.com. Many of the articles are written by Brother Duncan Burden, who has been a Freemason for most of his adult life and is a member of various Masonic bodies, such as the Royal and Select Master Masons and Operative Masons. He's also a member of the various Masonic chivalric orders, including Knight Templar, Knights of the Red Cross of Constantine. Born on the Norfolk coast, he now lives in Hertfordshire, England, and his blog can be found at http://humblemason.com. That's it for this week. I hope you guys all enjoyed the program. I have a blast every week recording these and reading all of these papers. I think at this point I've read volumes over the course of 319 episodes. Next week will be our 320th episode. It's so crazy to have gotten this far and brought this much light and information out to Masons and non-Masons alike. So just want to give a shout out to everybody who has been with us since the beginning. It wouldn't be possible without you guys. It is an absolute honor to be here week after week and bring these to you, so thank you so much. And of course, I have to say, we can't do it without you. So if you go to wcypodcast.com, go ahead and click through the links to support the show. You can hover over the Support the Show tab. You can make a direct donation, which will allow you to make a one-time donation or make recurrent donations. You can go and go to the limited edition shop, which will take you to the webpage where you can buy the that we've had designed by Brother Juan Sepulveda and Brother Jason Richards, made exclusively for us by Masonic Revival. You can't buy this pin anywhere else. It's ours. It's very unique. You can read a rundown of the multitude of symbols it contains in the symbolism of the actual pin, which the design also featured on some cufflinks, tie bars, and money clips. Additionally, if you'd like to get something for your money in return, you can do some shopping. If you click through our links for Onnit, you can get any number of those products to you for you by clicking through our link. And by doing that, then use the promo code WCY at checkout. You'll get 10% off your order every time. Go to buybankersbest.com or click through our links, which is better than he knows that you came through us to get to his website. That's Brother Levi Banker, who's been bringing you the best quality balms, beard oils, etc. for a long time now. You can read all about some of our great collaborative products, such as King Solomon's beard oil and balm, which we worked together with. He created this entire product. Even the art was outsourced to a Masonic artist for the bottle, so every bit of it's really kind of interesting and unique. And of course, we have our Thrive account, so you can click on WCY and Thrive. So check out all that stuff. You know, every week I have to tell you about this stuff because it's how we fund the show, and I understand if you guys fast forward or listen in double speed or whatever. Totally cool, but I have to mention it because this show doesn't happen without your support. So again, thank you so much for listening this week, and we'll talk to you all next week. And until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.